Members, yesterday I was trying to figure out whether or not we'd even be meeting today. Obviously, we're primarily waiting to get direction from our leadership in regards to the target. However, it certainly didn't feel appropriate for me not to meet today, particularly with 2 days out from the end of session. I think it's important for us to do everything possible to move anything that we can in this conference committee. At the end of the day, we are talking about a process where both sides need to agree in order to get things done. And there's certainly plenty of things here for us to, in my opinion, to agree to, and at the very least to deliberate over. As I said, we don't have targets yet, but certainly other conference committees have made progress in terms of moving, at the very least, same and similars, and moving policy provisions, primarily provisions without cost. We have a number of those that are present on the table here today. I have shared informally with my chair counterpart a list of 47 bills that have a zero-cost impact that are present on the table. 43 of those bills have Senate counterparts, where a senator has carried that provision in that body. Several of them also are present in the governor's budget proposal. So, members, there's lots of room for us to find common space, even if we don't agree with everything that that is out there. As the public knows, we spent a good week when the House had the gavel going through numerous policy provisions. We did that precisely so that everyone here can be in a position to act, so that everyone at least has a base knowledge of those provisions. Primarily, we wanted to make sure our Senate counterparts had an opportunity to hear those, to ask questions, and to engage in discussion. We did that more so with some bills than with others. And again, members, all of that, quite frankly, keeping with the past practice of this conference committee of vetting through provisions that one body had not heard, so that the other body could hear it, and in keeping with past practice for eventually accepting a number of those in the final product, including policy provisions. So today what I want to do is to two things, really quite simply. I want to spend a little bit of time up front with some stakeholders who are citizen advocates to briefly express the why. I'm a firm believer that as a legislator and as a legislature, as well as in our private lives, that the why should always be dictating what we do. I think the public expects nothing less of us than to be deliberative, reflective, and intentionally focused on the why for Minnesota. And so what I've asked in four broad theme areas, mental health, probation, decriminalizing poverty, and reform related to criminal sexual crimes of criminal sexual assault, is to express for us the why, the importance, and the urgency in many cases for this conference committee, for this legislature, to act on proposals that are sitting on the table here before us. Members, many of you know that I've spent a good decade at least in the education field. This is my first, foray, if you will, in public safety. I've served on this committee as recently as, at least on the House committee, as recently as 8 years ago. And spent an extensive period of time a long time ago when we had a committee that looked very similar to yours, Senator, where both judiciary and public safety were all together. But most of my most recent time has been spent in the education arena. And what I bring to this conversation, and I found it to be true as I've spent time out in the community, whether it's, you know, spending time out at Stillwater Prison or interacting with advocacy groups that work with women survivors, with mental health, with young people, is that there really are two Minnesotans. In education, this state, quite frankly, primarily kicks butt. We're consistently number one, number two, number three in a number of K-12 education measurements. And yet, by virtue of where you live in this state, if you live on the north side of Minneapolis, if you live in a low-income rural community, your school outcomes may not reflect that. And in fact, for communities of color, we have student outcomes that are below states that aggregate outcomes in states that we consider far behind our progress, far behind our quality of life and economic productivity. It is possible to have two Minnesotans, and I think our challenge before us is to have one Minnesota and to have a high-quality one Minnesota. And that is as true, I'm finding, in the sphere of public safety and corrections as it is in education. And so for me, the urgency of acting in this session, acting both in appropriations and in policy, speaks to this issue of two Minnesotans. It's easy for us to think that everything's fine in our state, and we have a great state. Frankly, members, everything is not fine everywhere. Our job here is to push forward laws that get us past that and move toward a consistently safe Minnesota that works for everyone. And so with that, I want to spend the first period of time. I don't want to spend a ton of time on this, but it's really a call out and a reminder for all of us as we get into the much more difficult interactions of making offers with one another in terms of what ought to be in this bill, to hear an appeal and a reminder from the voices of Minnesotans on why there should be action here today. So with that, and then the second part, I'll be posing a question to our Senate counterparts about how they wish to engage concretely in the short period of time that remains before us. And I'll come back to that in a second. But right now, what I want to do then is spend that first period of time going through those four themes, certainly open it up for questions and comments from committee members. And with that, I'm going to call forward under the
Mr. Chairman.
Criminalization of mental illness, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, before we go there, may I have a moment to address the conference committee?
Yes, of course, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, a week ago from last Thursday, we had a conference committee hearing considering the question of statute of limitations for criminal sexual conduct cases. I made some comments at that hearing that I later learned were particularly hurtful and in some views unbalanced with regard to how to approach that policy question. As a result, I reached out to a number of individuals to have some deeper conversations about it. I spoke with some survivors, had some very personal conversations with them. I spoke with some legislators who know more about this specific area of law than I do. And I spoke with some other experts in the field. And I went back and I listened to watched the recordings as well. And the manner of my comments, I think, were in some respects unbalanced certainly expressed some insensitivity or lack of sensitivity to the significance of the events for the victims or survivors of sexual assault. So I wanted to publicly say that I'm sorry for that. It was not my intent. to cause some of the reaction that I did. I know that I failed to include in my statement that I recognize the importance of justice for the survivors or victims of sexual assault, especially my comment regarding the accusations impacting the lives of the accused. What I left unstated, and certainly underappreciated, was that the far more ruinous impact that a sexual assault has on the crime victim. I did not appreciate, I'm not sure I ever could, fully appreciate the depth of trauma associated with being a victim of sexual assault. I want to also add that I was not defending perpetrators, but as members of the Senate committee know, I do vigorously defend due process, and that was my intent in my remarks, was to defend due process. Indeed, it's the cornerstone of our constitutional protections. We need to find balance in our criminal justice system by providing justice for the victims and protecting the rights of the accused. Now, that said, I took a much deeper dive into the policy issue. I analyzed and learned more about the other crimes for which there is no statute of limitations. Very few, by the way, in Minnesota statutes. Murder or any crime resulting in death, kidnapping, child labor trafficking, for minors, victims of sexual abuse or sexual assaults. I learned more about the impact on the memory of adult victims of sexual abuse, more akin to that of child victims. I learned about the significance of having the ability to report and have investigated by law enforcement, even if a crime is not prosecutable ultimately. And while I do believe that adults should be more responsible for choosing whether to report than child victims, I do not believe I appreciated the silencing effect of this particular offense, unlike any other offenses that we have in Minnesota. I reviewed in detail the elements of the several sexual conduct crimes that are included in the proposal, some of which are quite heinous. I would like to think that policymakers, and particularly legislators, are capable of, even required, to reanalyze, to relearn, and to adjust their position on policy proposals to do what they conclude is right when they get new information and when they come to a new understanding of a particular proposal. And that's what I'm doing here. I've concluded that eliminating the statute of limitations on certain sexual assault crimes as proposed in the House language is the right policy. And I encourage Chairman Limmer and my other Senate colleagues to accept the House's proposal on that policy question that's before us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time.
Thank you, Senator Letts. It's an honorable thing that you do. I'm not just talking about the proposal. That's always a debatable issue, but certainly honorable for you to share your reflection of your interaction, of our interaction with the public, and your stating your intentions in a way that upholds the, I believe, what is the best of our two institutions here. One of the challenging things that we do here is that we have to ask tough questions. I think the public expects us to do that. Often we have to perhaps help one another to be able to do that in such a way that engages and respects the inherent dignity that exists with all human beings. And if at any point any one of us falls short of that, it certainly is appropriate, certainly honorable, but appropriate that we acknowledge that. Senator Letts, I've served with you for a long time. We were in the House together. Your integrity and the humbleness with which you approach this work is beyond reproach in my mind. And you've just reminded me of why I've placed that trust in you. And I thank you for sharing your statement here today. Hopefully we'll have a conversation in the hours to come relative to that particular provision itself. Senator Lim, I believe you want to, did you want to say something? Well, I'm sorry. I thought I saw you waving at me, so very well. Senator Letts, thank you. Appreciate it. With that, members, I'm going to ask under the theme of criminalization of mental illness for Sue Adler-Holden from NAMI to come forward. Ms. Adler-Holden. And again, you know, we're members, this is a quick reminder and centering for our upcoming conversations on the why and the urgencies of now, the importance of a number of proposals that, in this case, fall under the broad umbrella of the intersect of mental illness and public safety. Ms. Adler-Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sue Adler-Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. So people with mental illnesses are overrepresented in our criminal and juvenile justice systems. Often it's due to undertreated or untreated mental illness and often nonviolent crimes. It could be someone is psychotic or is having delusional thoughts, ends up in someone else's house when they think it's their own, or just kind of public nuisance issues, or someone's manic and is doing something pretty risky, or they're suicidal, perhaps, and that they have a gun. Around 60% of the people in our jails are experiencing symptoms of a mental illness, and one-third are on medications to actually treat a mental illness. Over 25% of the people in our prisons are taking medication for a mental illness, and it's even higher, over 75% among women in our prisons. In our juvenile justice system, 70% of the youth have one or more mental health diagnoses. And it's important to remember that 50% of mental illnesses emerge by the age of 14 and 75% by the age of 24. And particularly in the juvenile justice system, this has largely become our mental health system for kids of color. People with untreated mental illnesses are 16 times more likely to be killed during a police encounter than other civilians approached or stopped by law enforcement. 4 out of the 12 people killed by police last year had a mental illness. And while we have long required a mental health screening of people entering the jails, there is not always a next step when someone screens positive. We're seeing an increased number of people deemed incompetent to stand trial. The 48-hour law has resulted in most of the state-operated beds being occupied by people coming from the jail, causing log jams in the continuum of our community mental health system. And what is distressing to advocates is that the mental health treatment that people need in jails, prisons, detention facilities is often unavailable or very limited. There may be limited drug formularies, rarely is therapy provided, discharge planning is rare, and frankly, the outcomes are not good. The frequent utilizers of emergency rooms in jails almost always have a mental illness, along with a substance use disorder, and they're typically homeless. And I might add, they're typically homeless because of the collateral consequences. We have heard countless stories at NAMI where the intersection with the criminal justice system could have been avoided. Now, certainly having a mental health system would help, and I would say that our mental health system is not broken. It has never been built. The institutions were not a mental health system. But we face discrimination under Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance. We've relied on block grants to fund our mental health system, and during the last recession, the legislature cut over $50 million from the mental health system. That being said, though, when someone comes into the criminal justice system, there is more that we could do. And what we see is perhaps someone's having a crisis and the family calls 911 and they send out police instead of a mobile crisis team. Police respond to the mental health crisis where de-escalation is not used and the person unintentionally hits an officer and is now charged with a crime and ends up in jail instead of the hospital. A person is in jail and the family desperately tries to get them their medication to no avail, or their medication is changed, including antipsychotics, while in jail. A person misses their court date because they're in an inpatient psychiatric unit, a warrant is issued, and they're arrested upon discharge. A mom is worried that her son in jail is suicidal, but there's no easy way to figure out who to call after 5 o'clock. A young man under the age of 26, our brain is, you know, doesn't finish growing until around 26, is in solitary confinement for almost a year. And a person is discharged from the jail with 2 days of medication and no prescriber in the community to continue it. Or someone is discharged from prison and they're staying, they're supposed to stay in treatment, but they can't find an appointment. We do have a crisis in terms of the intersection of the criminal justice system and mental illnesses and substance use disorders. And unfortunately, this crisis isn't new. It's been here for decades, despite numerous reports from the OLA and other entities to change it. And I mean, I could have had a wagon to pull in all the reports that have been done on the intersection of mental illness and the criminal justice system. There's been 2 just in the last 5 years from the OLA about mental health services in the jails and in the prisons. I can say that we absolutely do know what to do. And while certainly we can look to other committees such as HHS or housing to address this issue by increasing funding for our mental health system and ending homelessness, the reality is that there are concrete steps this committee can take this session to address this very serious issue. The sequential intercept model, which has been around for 20 years, lays out very clearly the steps that we can take to divert people from the criminal justice system and into the mental health system, or to ensure that they receive mental health treatment when they that they need. So this includes police training so that they know how to de-escalate the situation and engage the person having a mental health crisis. It includes JDAI initiatives to address the symptoms and trauma experienced by these young people and provide treatment, not punishment. We have 14 counties involved. 8 of them were just added in 2016, and yet we know that this works, and we haven't done more. It includes jail diversion programs such as the Yellow Line Project, so people are connected to treatment and housing instead of jail. It includes treatment courts that have proven to be very successful in addressing the underlying reason why someone comes into contact with the criminal justice system. And after all these years, we still only have 3 mental health courts in Minnesota. And we need to have enough public defenders so that their caseloads aren't so high that they don't have time to seek alternatives. And it includes increasing staffing at our prisons so that adequate, not superb, but adequate mental health and substance use disorder treatment can be provided, and we can reduce the use of solitary confinement, which we know has a negative impact on people's mental health. We can do more discharge planning so people are connected to the treatment they need in the community. And it includes changes to community supervision, especially for people with serious mental illnesses, to keep them connected to treatment and housing. And frankly, it includes reinstating the ombudsman to hold our systems accountable for basic standards, including basic mental health treatment. Again, rest assured that NAMI is advocating loudly to other conference committees so that we can continue to build our mental health system. But this committee, this year, this day, can take steps to address this urgent crisis. I urge you to not let this go unaddressed again. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. I'm reminded this year of a gentleman who walked from up north, I forget how many hundreds of miles. I think you know the gentleman I'm speaking with on behalf of his daughter, who is caught up in a tough situation in our criminal justice system, shuffling from jail to jail. I think it was prison time as well. And getting into deeper and deeper problems related to her behavior, which stems from some severe mental illness issues that our quote-unquote system just doesn't have services for her. As a parent, his expectation certainly wasn't that his daughter wind up in our criminal justice system, but once she did, he thought that there would be some kind of a net there to provide strong intervention and guidance for her, and he discovered his parental dismay that there's nothing, practically nothing there. Some of you have met this gentleman, probably know the story I'm telling. I think it's illustrative of the challenge that we had before us. You know, during our gun discussion, the Senate Chair and I were chatting, the Senate Chair shared his concern for mental illness issues, you know, stemming from some of the ancillary issues that rolls out of gun violence. So I know that there's an interest, I don't think there's a partisan issue here before us. I think there's an issue of will for both bodies and for both parties, and I hope that we can make some strong steps this year. Are there any questions or thoughts? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Averholden, for being here today. And I've had the opportunity to hear you testify to the Education Policy Committee, which I'm on also. And I'll just say, you know, with Education Minnesota and the teachers here today, every teacher that I've talked to has talked about the growing number of students in their classrooms with mental illness. And talking today to a second grade teacher who said more than 50% of the kids in her second grade classroom have diagnosed mental illnesses. And so this is obviously an issue that we have to address, you know, from birth until whenever, but, you know, to the extent that we don't take care of things in the public safety realm, we've got all of these students, if they're not getting treatment, then coming up possibly into our criminal justice system too. So it's just a really urgent need. It's an urgent need at all age levels. And I just appreciate you being here, and your work really touches a lot of different committees that that we work on. So thank you so much.
Representative Bentall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder, Ms. Averholden, could you just briefly just cite provisions in either the bill, just maybe just comment about what you see coming out of these two visions? In particular, are there provisions that you very much would want to see advanced that are contained in either bill and or the impact of the funding decisions that have been made through these bills?
Yes.
Ms. Averholden.
Just a second. Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's $1 million to do the psychological exams for the increased number of people deemed incompetent to stand trial. Those need to be done. Funding to sustain the current treatment courts, these are in the House bill. Increase in the number of lawyers in the public defender's office. Funding to restart the corrections ombudsman program. Funding and language to reform the use of solitary confinement. Funding for police training is in both. At different levels, increasing the funding for legal representation for children in the child protection system, because that's also an incredible need. Funding for opioid treatment for offenders, including those being released to the community. Funding to promote alternatives to incarceration. Mental health community supervision for people on probation, parole, or supervised release. The staff increase in the Minnesota prisons. And then promoting alternatives to arrest for juvenile offenders, including the creation of a neutral risk assessment tool. In the Senate bill, again, there is some money for police training. There's money for the Yellow Line program, including expanding it to other counties. There's funding for a specialized mental health community supervision in Anoka County. That's my initial list.
Any further questions, comments? Representative Sirleaf.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Averholden, for coming in to visit with us this afternoon. And, Mr. Chair, I couldn't not take a moment to highlight the segregation provision, the segregation reform provision within the bill. In the corrections article in the House language. And it's something that, you know, we've been working on here as part of the legislature over the last 3 years and working very closely with the Department of Corrections and the new commissioner. Commissioner Schnell is supportive of our language and the approach that we've taken this year in really highlighting the impact that segregation can have, and doing baseline monitoring to make sure that individuals that have a decline in mental health while in solitary confinement or in segregation are assessed and treated appropriately. And then the process also, the bill also has provisions within it for making sure that the commissioner is alerted as people are kept within segregation for different periods of time, and then minimizing what we've heard so much about, which is individuals that are being released after 400, 500, 600, 700 days in solitary confinement directly out of prison and into the public, and clearly not being prepared for that release. And so I wanted to highlight that. Thank Ms. Abderholden for coming in today. And just, you know, I say it a lot, but I truly, truly believe it, Mr. Chair, in the way we take care of people in the state of Minnesota. In no other setting, in no other medical condition, would we take individuals exhibiting signs and symptoms of that medical condition and lock them in a closet for 400, 500, 600, or 700 days. If you had heart disease, we'd treat your heart disease. If you're diabetic, we'd treat your diabetes. In our prison system, if you have persistent severe mental illness and you act out, you will likely spend the bulk of your sentence in solitary confinement. And that is not what we should be doing. It is not the way we should handle individuals with a medical disease. And so my hope is, in working with the department and working with the commissioner and putting in these provisions, that we can address many of these issues. And at the very least, Mr. Chair, at the very least, we can have the appropriate monitoring and reporting back to the legislature, which today does not occur. And for 3 years, I've been trying to get the data and the information on the population within solitary confinement. And for 3 years, I've been unable to get even that base data. That's a problem, that is troubling, and that's something that would be addressed within the solitary confinement provision within the House bill. And so I just want to highlight that and thank Ms. Abderholden for coming in.
Thank you, Representative Sirwas, and thank you for your work on this over the past many years. Perhaps this will be a year where we can make some progress, important progress toward that. Are there any other questions or thoughts? Are there any questions or thoughts from our Senate counterparts relative to mental illness and the nexus of that in criminal justice system? If not, Ms. Abderholden, thank you for your testimony today, and thank you for your persistent and awesome work for good public policy on behalf of Minnesotans facing mental illness.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. With that, members, our next theme is the criminalization of poverty. This actually encompasses a broad group of areas. You probably won't hear from all of them, but we have Ms. Melissa Lesh from the Justice Action Network. Bill Ward, public defender, and Mary Ellen Hain, and the Minneapolis City Attorney. Leah Jackson. Okay, who's an impacted individual? Please come forward. Oh, she did? Okay. And we'll hear from Marion Green, Commissioner Green as well, after these folks. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Chair Mariani, Chair Lesh, Chair Limmer, members of the committee, my name is Melissa Lesh and I represent the Justice Action Network, the first and largest bipartisan network in the country to bring together conservative and progressive partners and collaborate with law enforcement, business, civil rights, victims' rights, and faith-based groups to make our justice system more effective and cost-efficient. Our partners include organizations from across the political spectrum, such as the ACLU, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, and the Southern Poverty Law Center. We work in 17 states to advance locally driven policy changes, such as reform in the areas of driver's license suspension, civil asset forfeiture, and probation. States as diverse as Mississippi and Maine, Tennessee and New York have recognized that punishing residents simply due to their inability to pay tickets or court debt rather than their actual behavior does nothing to advance public safety or accountability, places a significant burden on limited resources of law enforcement, creates a revolving door of court debt, and prevents people from driving legally to work, which hurts families, businesses, employers, and the community as a whole. National data indicate that 64% of low-income drivers who lose their license lose their jobs, only furthering the cycle of poverty and debt. The legislation on driver's license suspension reform that we have supported for several years in Minnesota is representative of both federal and state trends in policymaking. Years of in-depth research and analysis have revealed that these approaches simply do not work and are in fact counterproductive. Lawmakers throughout the country are electing to put down the sledgehammer of punishing the inability to pay and instead picking up the policy scalpel and crafting approaches that actually have the desired effect of addressing behavior and reducing recidivism, thus providing significant savings and enhancing public safety, accountability, and justice. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would turn it over to my colleagues.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I've spoken to many of you, I think, before. I'm Mary Ellen Hang. I am the criminal deputy at the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. I have been a misdemeanor prosecutor my entire career, going on almost now 22 years. And I can personally attest to what I've seen as a prosecutor, not only the impact of criminalizing poverty, but as our previous speaker spoke, the impact of mental illness has on especially the work that I do at my level. As a prosecutor, my primary responsibility is to ensure public safety, represent public safety, ensure our communities are safe, getting justice for victims, but also balancing that with accountability and fairness to the individuals that are in the system. And I can tell you that suspending people's driver's licenses because they simply are too poor to pay the court fees and the fines, which frankly can add up to a significant dollar amount. I have seen tickets with multiple counts total up $800-$900. That is simply not a good way to enhance public safety. As a prosecutor, I want licensed and insured drivers on the road, and we should be doing everything we can to make that possible. And I would rather focus my office resources on the distracted driving, the drunk driving, the impaired driving, the true public safety risks. My caseload in my office, about 30% of our caseload is spent on people driving without valid licenses and then also without insurance. And that's simply not a good use of my prosecutorial resources. And this is not just a problem in Minneapolis, it is statewide. And we need to ensure that people have the means to support their families, get to jobs, and have the resources to do what they need to do. We've done a lot of work, not only in driver's license reform, but my office has done a lot of work around bail reform. all for the same reasons. We know that there are people that simply are in jail because they can't afford to post bail. That's not the purpose of bail. Bail is to ensure that people show up for court, and it's to enhance public safety, make sure those that are truly a danger to the public are not out in the public. So we have adopted a sign and release warrant where we people that don't show up for court the first time, when a law enforcement officer encounters them, they're given a court date on the spot. And in that practice, it's been going on for a couple of years, two-thirds of the people that are given court dates show up. We have created a new restorative court in Hennepin County to address the underlying issues, mental health, homelessness, substance abuse, people charged with low-level misdemeanors. And I've been astonished as I work in that court that this is voluntary. They are given off an opportunity to work with social workers and work on whatever issues they may have. People are showing up. They're meeting with their social workers. They're addressing their issues, and we're able to give them positive outcomes, which a lot of times is dismissing their cases, because part of criminalizing poverty is adding on to criminal convictions. How many trespassing convictions does it take before we realize it's not doing any good to continue to convict people? And the people that I see come through those courts, I know there are some people, I think, that are concerned that this might allow people to not take accountability. That's not what I see. Two-thirds of people, when given a chance, are coming to their court date when they know they have a court date. That's extraordinary. On a day that we had a massive blizzard, every other courtroom was bare of defendants. I did restorative court. Every single defendant showed up. One person walked 2 hours in the snow because he knew he had court. These are people that want to be responsible. They want to be accountable. We need to build a system that allows them to do that. So I urge you to pass the driver's license suspension bill. I urge you to look at the surcharge bill, a system where an administrative fee is simply higher than the fine, which is supposed to be the penalty, the consequence for the behavior. That's simply not just. I think we're doing a lot of good work in this issue. In these areas, there's a lot more that we can do, especially at the misdemeanor level. And I thank you for looking at these bills, and I urge you to pass these bills.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes. Mr. Ward.
Chair Mariani, Chair Limmer, committee members, I'm actually filling in for Jeanette Berner, who would probably do a much more able job than me on the issues that have been going on in Hennepin County and working with Ms. Hang on these issues from Minneapolis. I appreciate Ms. Hang talking about that this is not an urban issue. This is a statewide issue. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm the state public defender. We represent over 150,000 cases per year in this state, every single year, over 150,000 cases. By definition, my clients are poor. And by definition, these proposed bills are assisting my clients that are in the system. We represent in total over 64% of the people who are charged in this system, and they are affected adversely by the current statutes on surcharges and on fines that are not waivable. I can't explain to you enough, you know, the bail issue I've talked to all of you about in the past, about people who are poor, who sit in jail simply because they cannot come up with the $75 or $78 to get back on the street. They don't have the money. And I know when people look at me askance saying, well, how can they not come up with it? They simply do not understand the lives of my clients. The same with these issues. It's a ticket. You know, people say, well, pay your ticket. It's a choice between feeding your family or paying a ticket. You're going to feed your kids. It's pure and simple. And they say, well, what's the issue then? Well, if they don't go to court, they don't pay the ticket, their license is suspended. And there are tens of thousands of cases of suspended licenses in this system. We represent those individuals. And once they're in that system and they don't pay those fines and fees or misdemeanors, or for a lack of insurance, it's a misdemeanor charge. And it's a vicious cycle. $900 is not unique. It gets up into the thousands of dollars for failure to pay a simple ticket. People just cannot comprehend that. And then people could be looking at jail too. That's criminalization of poverty, pure and simple. I'm asking this body to think seriously about what we've done in the past and who it has affected. It is not a revenue-raising resource. The effect of it is to harm the poor. The surcharges, as Ms. Hang talks about, being more than a fine, and those aren't waivable. If you look at these issues, think in terms of being able to waive based upon ability to pay. Think in terms of this is not a good way of raising resources to fund the state coffers. It just simply is not. It's putting fines and fees on the poor, and ultimately it's putting them in debtor's prison and in jails. The idea finally of, well, they, you know, make it into a system where it simply is a debt that they have to pay off. That collateral consequences harms them as well for the rest of their lives if you make it into a judgment. So I urge you to seriously, not just to consider, but to understand how my clients are currently facing these situations in this state and how you have the ability to change how they have to approach mere tickets in our system that become a vicious cycle for them.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. Ms. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So I'm going to tell you just a personal story that I have about my experience with driver's license suspensions. I know some of you have heard this before. But 4.5 years ago, I was pulled over for an intersection gridlock. So basically, we're taking a left turn at a yellow light. I was given a traffic ticket, and that was $135. Well, at that time, I had just moved alone by myself. I had just started a new job. In fact, I was on job training when I got this ticket. And I wanted to pay it, but I had to make sure that I could cover my rent and all that stuff since it was my first time doing this. So my plan was just to wait a little bit, get myself settled, get caught up, and then pay this ticket, not knowing that it would cause me so many problems. Well, a few months later, I was pulled over and told that my license was suspended. And I had never been given a notice. I had no idea of this. Probably wouldn't have been driving if I did. My job at the time, it required me to make bank runs specifically, make deliveries, amongst other duties requiring me to drive. So my position was threatened. Therefore, I just kept driving. So I'd received, after that first driving after suspension, I had two more within 2 weeks. And at that point, I kind of just stopped driving. But they were $283 each. So now about $1,000 that I had in fines. So that, you know, takes me even longer to try to figure out how to pay for that. But I ended up using my entire tax return to pay for all of this. And luckily I was able to speak with a hearing officer, and I actually only paid $800. So saved a couple $100 there. So a few months went by, and, you know, I thought I was in the clear. I thought everything was over and it was done with. But that was not so. I received a notice from my car insurance that they would be no longer accepting me as a client because of these driving after suspension tickets. So I had to figure out what I was going to do. So I, at the another job I had at the time, I was connected with a insurance broker who did a lot of work for me and was able to get me insurance for $650 a month. More than I was paying for rent at the time. But of course that's gone down now, and I'm only at about $200 a month now. But you know, with this fines and the added cost of insurance, these total expenses were over $16,000 for me over the past 4.5 years. You know, and a lot of people don't realize that not everybody has help. I definitely didn't. Not everybody has that privilege. You know, and I can't even imagine what it would have been like if I had kids to support or a family or anybody. But it was just me, and this was such a problem. But, yeah, and, you know, if it hadn't been for that one ticket, that if I could have just paid that one ticket, I wouldn't have had all of these problems. I would have been able, you know, to keep my license. I would have been able to not drive illegally, because that's not fun. And, you know, my insurance rates would have stayed affordable.
One ticket. Thank you, Ms. Jackson. We have Marion Green, and just stay there if you could. Maybe the commissioner can just join you quickly, and there should be an extra chair. Someone can slide over. Afternoon, Commissioner.
Afternoon. Thank you. I'm not used to being shorter. Dive in.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you, Chair Limmer, and thank you, members. I'm Marion Green, and I'm chair of the Hennepin County Board. I want to thank you for inviting me to speak today, and thank you particularly for your interest in criminal justice reform and public safety. So in 2017, Hennepin County experienced a big spike in our jail population. We were concerned about what the drivers were, and as government leaders, wanted to understand what levers were within our reach and what levers weren't to change that. On the topic of bail reform, bail is about flight risk. And I think we all share the common goal of making sure that bail is not a pre-punishment, not a barrier to people who have not been convicted to continuing to live their lives. Counties end up having to pay, having to support people whose lives are disrupted by not being able to pay bail, notably without any related benefit in public safety, in fact, possibly decreased public safety. And this is why Hennepin County testified in the House in support of Representative Knorr's bill on bail reform, House File 741. So, with all that in mind, let's return to that increase in Hennepin County's jail population. We contracted with two retired judges, both of whom were alumni of the Fourth Circuit, which geographically overlaps perfectly with Hennepin County. And they spent a number of months gathering data, studying jail population drivers, helping the county and current bench understand what levers were within reach. This two-pager, and I think that you all have a copy of it. This two-pager provides a really excellent and meaty summary of their findings. And on the reverse, I want to draw your eye particularly to recommendation number 6. Number 6 highlights the need to consider book and release for individuals held on low bail. The bench has a particular role to play, as does state law. This is a national bipartisan conversation, and on behalf of Hennepin County, I am ready to partner with you on this important conversation at the state level. To reiterate some of my opening points, bail is about flight risk, and we all share the common goal of making sure that bail is not a pre-punishment, not a barrier to people who have not been convicted continuing to live their lives. And there are costs, there are dollar costs and human costs to the current approach. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions? Chairman Lesh.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And before my question, Ms. Jackson, thank you for being willing to come back this many times on this. That's pretty impressive. Especially when you got a lot of other things to do. I remember when I was in your shoes and I'd get a ticket. And as a young man, I was hyper-conscious of getting any kind of ticket and causing my insurance rates to go up because I knew as a early 20-something young man, the insurance rates were killer. So I tried to keep stuff off my record. And I had a bit of a lead foot back then. Don't say anything. Yeah, no, don't say it, Mrs. Lesh, that I still do. But back then I definitely did. And I noted that, you know, when you're young, and this it reminded me of this when I started prosecuting for 15 years for the city of St. Paul, and the plurality of my cases were those driving after cases. And when someone came in, I would routinely get people come in and saying, I didn't even know my license was suspended all the time. And I would explain to them, well, all that the Department of Public Safety has to do is send a letter to your last address we have on file for you, and that's proof that you had notice. And they'd routinely say, well, I didn't live there. I lived there for, you know, a little while, but I've since moved. And then I would explain to them, well, state law requires that you change your license within 30 days of moving, too. So we got them every which way. I mean, there's no wiggle room on this. And as a young person, that's routinely how you live. You move a lot. Sometimes you don't keep your license updated as quick as you can. By the way, if I had – I'm not going to ask for a show of hands in this room, but I wonder how many people license in this room if their address is correct on their license. And I don't need an answer, but people are thinking right now, whoa, 30 days, holy cow, that's pretty quick. Yeah, it is pretty quick. And if you're in a bad position of that means suddenly you're driving suspended without knowing it, it makes a huge difference on someone when they're young and when they're poor. The question that I had related more to Mr. Ward and Ms. Heng being up there, it's not lost on me that the agency that prosecutes more cases in this state than anyone else, and the agency that defends more cases than anyone else in this state have joined forces and agreed on this. Can you tell me how it is that you came together? And I know it's not just you. It's also, you know, St. Paul, and it's, you know, Ramsey County and other agencies around the state that agree with this. But how is it that your conversation started about, hey, listen, you know, normally we're on the opposite sides of this kind of stuff. People that come before this committee, you got law enforcement and you got defense. What was the tipping point for you that you saw this is not a sustainable program we got going on?
Ms. Haynes?
Representative Lesh, Chair and members of the committee, and I wish she, I think she's maybe still here in the hall. I think it's kind of unique, but Ms. Borner, Jeanette, and I have worked together a long, long time. We kind of came up together as line prosecutor, public defender, and when we got into management positions, we were given the unique opportunity to really look at a lot of these issues, and we realized that from both our perspectives, the system wasn't working the way it needed to work, and it was causing issues in my office and resource issues in her office, and we could continue to just stay in our silos and do our thing and not worry about it, or we could try to make change. And we honestly had a really unique opportunity in Hennepin County. A few years ago, we formed an adult detention initiative, and it brought all the key players together. And we came together and had very honest conversations about all sorts of issues in the system, including driver's license, tickets, bail reform. And we just, all of us realized something needs to change. And so I got lucky enough to chair the bench warrant committee. And so we just started brainstorming, and we came up with some of these ideas, sign and release, book and release. And we had great support to initiate these because from my perspective, I thought, I don't really think anything that I can come up with is going to make it worse. I just didn't see how we could do that. I thought at best we can only make it better. And we so far have had a lot of success with our initiatives. But I think I've been very privileged to go around the country to a lot of conferences to talk about these issues. And I, before I started doing that, I took for granted how well our offices work together. And then I would meet other prosecutors and public defenders who would say, we never speak to each other. We barely speak to each other to negotiate a case. And so I've really come to appreciate how collaborative we are and that we have a very supportive bench and now hopefully on the state level, because I think that's the only way change gets made. And so I think we just realized it can't be done by one agency, and we just finally decided we have to do something, and we just started moving things forward. And as we started having success, it became a little easier to have those conversations.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, I'm glad that Ms. Hanks said that. I used to be the chief of Hennepin County, and she'd never said that we worked well together when I was there. So that's the reality is, or these issues have been around for a very long period of time, and I'm really proud of the work that our office has done through Jeanette's leadership on this issue, working with Mary Ellen Hang and Susan Siegel, and clearly with the support of the commissioners there. We have been saying for years that a substantial part of our caseload are really nonviolent driving offenses, you know, drive after suspension, no insurance, and it takes a tremendous amount of time. You know, you think you just talk and then you plead them out, but, you know, the repercussions of a plea, the collateral consequences of a plea are just mind-boggling and take a substantial amount of resources, not just from my office, but certainly for the jails, that people are sitting in jail at $100-something per day. It's important for people to know that each county has a criminal justice coordinating committee that should be talking about these issues. What is clear is when I worked there, and I know it has been since I've been there, is that Hennepin County takes that committee very seriously. All of the stakeholders are a part of those discussions, and they've taken the walls down from the silo to come up with solutions of issues we've known about for a long time. So they deserve a tremendous amount of credit. Our chiefs are trying to do the same thing in other areas. Obviously, it's nice to have one county or one district start something or one city start something and then steal those ideas and hope to implement them in other counties throughout the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So it sounds like issues have been around for a long time. And what I'm hearing, tell me if I'm hearing this correct, that if approached in a certain way, a certain way, frankly, are in some of the bills that are before us, we can not only save people from sliding into worse outcomes, but we can save government money?
Yes. Mr. Chair, yes, I would agree, because I think part of what we need to start thinking about is what you hear a theme is that whether they know they should be driving or not, people are driving. And the same with people that have mental illness. They're out there committing crimes. And our goal, especially when we're talking about nonviolent, low-level offenses, part of it is to try to make the individual well and restore communities, but it is about reducing recidivism. That is where you do save the dollars. And having people revolve through the door, and on a misdemeanor, you're talking about 90 days in jail with good time, that's 2 months. Putting someone in jail at $140 a day for 60 days to let them out and have them still have a mental illness or a substance abuse or a suspended license, knowing they're going to come back, where is that getting us other than spending money to get nothing as a, you know, as an outcome? And so I think we've tried to shift our work to really look at what is the underlying issue? Is it a money issue? Is it a mental illness, whatever? And let's start working on that, because that's what stops people from coming back into the system that truly are coming in because of the issues that they have. And the goal should always be to reduce that recidivism, because that's what protects public safety, makes communities viable, and it's better for the individuals that Mr. Ward's staff represents.
And Mr. Chair, can I just say one thing? Just as a reminder to the committee members, other than the metro area and perhaps Moorhead or Rochester, Duluth, there is no public transportation outstate. It doesn't exist. So for people to pick up their kids from child care, to get groceries, to go to work, to go to court, they have to drive. The idea of depending on someone else to bring them to and from any daily task cannot be met by public transportation in the vast majority of this geographical state. And that's why it's so insidious outstate as much as it is in the metro area, because these folks have no choice but to drive their vehicles.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add, just by way of example, when we're looking at that $75 state surcharge that's tacked on to all of these tickets, over 90% of non-public defender cases, that's paid. People are able to pay that. But when we're looking at the population that Mr. Ward represents, well over 50% of those tickets fall into default. So we're not getting blood from a turnip now anyways. People can't pay what they don't have. So that's why we're looking at some of these ideas of having enhanced flexibility around that surcharge, whether that's scalable to income, community service, things of that nature. Because the state, you can count the number of citations until you're blue in the face. We're not collecting that money now anyways. So if those were more appropriate to someone's particular income level, then a higher rate of payment would be possible. Might be a lower dollar amount. Maybe it's $25 instead of $75. But the state could potentially then make up for in volume in that lower level dollar amount for the collection being more attainable.
Sure, green savings in your county.
Well, thank you. I wanted to add, Ms. Heng did a really nice job of elaborating on the costs. And of course, there are incredible costs to keeping people in jail when really is that reducing rates of recidivism. But there are also costs afterwards, of course, the lost job. You know, somebody loses their health care, somebody loses their housing. And that's where the county really finds the expense, is kind of on those tail expenses that follow the person afterwards and really disrupt their lives, disrupt their children's lives. And that's also a place where the county feels there's just incredible expense at no benefit.
Well, and I suspect members, when we look at fiscal notes, we're often more focused and interested on state impacts, but we also know that a number of our decisions have impacts on local government financing. And it's something that we do pay close attention to in terms of our policy proposals here. Representative Pinto, you had something?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, Ms. Lesh, I know that my understanding is Justice Action Network, where you work, is a collaboration of progressive and conservative groups and kind of part of a movement I think there is on the conservative side of the political spectrum in favor of criminal justice reform. Is there anything you want to add to any of this? kind of from that perspective, from the political conservative perspective, as to why folks would, from that perspective, might want to be particularly supportive of the kind of ideas that have been discussed here.
Certainly, Mr. Ms. Chair, Lash. Representative Pinto, thank you for the comment and the question. The U.S. Justice Action Network is active right now in 17 states and also a leader at the federal level, most recently working on the drug sentencing reform that just passed earlier this year. And I think coming at it from primarily two perspectives, one really is that cost savings, but this revolving door that we've been talking about is phenomenally expensive. So from a taxpayer perspective, as Ms. Hang mentioned, about 30% of just Minneapolis's resources in their prosecutor's office are dedicated to this revolving door that leads to nowhere. So from a cost savings perspective, that's how we approach it. But then, you know, also from a being smart about crime perspective, you know, that if what we're really trying to accomplish is true public safety, as Ms. Hang again noted, her time is better spent on reckless driving, DWI, distracted driving, things of that nature, and not continuing to, you know, cite people like Ms. Jackson, who her really, you know, the underlying violation was something that, you know, is fairly minimal, but racking up all those tickets, that's not a good way for our limited law enforcement resources to be spent as well. So those are the two perspectives that we approach as that. And this is spreading nationwide. We're seeing reforms really tackling this criminalization of poverty issue in states that are, conservative from the legislative and gubernatorial perspective, and also on the more progressive side. So that's why, you know, it's exciting to be working on this, that this is just the right policy approach right now.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. We do often pride ourselves as being the leaders of the pack on public policy. It sounds like we can do some catching up with some others across the nation as well. Chairman Lesh, you had a follow-up, and I apologize, I didn't catch that.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. explain this to me, assuming I'm a cynic. I know it's my bill, but let's say I'm a cynic, because I did know a prosecutor once who had a sign hanging in her office that said, if he who breaks the law is not punished, he who obeys the law is cheated, which is one way to look at things. But assuming that I had that perspective, and you had to explain to me why these people who were going to continue to drive on suspended license should not somehow get some kind of additional punishment for not following the straight and narrow like the rest of us. Why is it that we should give them a break on this? Well, why does that make sense from a prosecution and a defense and a societal standpoint? Normally, you know, when I first came in, your first one was petty. Your second one was a misdemeanor, no time. Third one was a misdemeanor, no time. Fourth one, we gave you 3 days in jail. Or no, 15 days in jail. And we stacked 3 days every day thereafter. So someone would come in with 10 driving after suspensions, didn't find out to the eighth one that he was suspended even, and you stack those up, and next thing you know, you're at 33 days in jail, a month in jail for that, with one-third off for good time. Why is it that it makes sense to give these folks a break?
Mr. Chair and Chair Lash, I think I would point to a couple things, and then I would ask Ms. Hang if she had anything to add as well. Number one, Minnesota does have a habitual offender law, and the policy that we are advocating for this year does nothing to change that. So if a driver has, I think it's 5 tickets in 1 year or
four in a year
or 5 in 2 years, that driver's license will be suspended. So that remains unchanged. So there is a backstop that you know, you cannot continue to rack up tickets ad nauseum, because there does need to be some accountability. And then in addition to that, I would add that what we're really focused on is that underlying violation. And actually, Chair Limmer, I think this is on point to a bill that you've worked on for a while that really differentiates between conduct behind the wheel and behavior versus the actual payment of the ticket being the crime.
So if, you know, if the conduct behind the wheel is egregious and someone is suspended for that reason, the legislation that, that we're supporting would do nothing to change that. So if someone has their license suspended for, say, DWI, and they continue to drive on that suspended license, the legislation that we're supporting does not change that. But if it's just that inability to pay and it's under that habitual offender limit, that is that criminalization of poverty that, that we're attempting to address.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair.
Chair Lewis.
I just, no more questions on this, but thank you for the, that answer. And one of the things I was thinking about when I led with that, that sign that was hanging in that prosecutor's office is that prosecutor happened to be one of the chief proponents of the diversion program in St. Paul and work with you folks over there, okay? And I asked her about this once. Why is it that we should be letting people off with a diversion program, even though I supported the diversion program? And she said, we've gotten to the point where we're not punishing these folks anymore. We're punishing ourselves. We're punishing the court system. We're punishing the prosecution's office. We're punishing the court calendars. Nobody is getting anything out of this, except we're attempting to squeeze folks for money that they don't have. It makes zero sense. And so we need to move out of this cycle of destruction for our own systems where we're trying to take care of everyone else, like you just said, the cases that really deserve attention. So thank you for that.
Senator Pinto, you had a follow-up.
Just a really quick one, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask Ms. Hang if she's concerned about higher-income people not paying tickets if we were to end driver's license suspensions or go forward with this policy. I can imagine somebody expressing that concern. I just wanted you to provide you a chance to respond to that concern.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, that there are already people that simply do not care. And with making no change this year at all, we have a bucket of people. They are going to do what they're going to do, and they don't care, and they could have means to pay, and they're simply not going to. We can't change that behavior, but I believe that there is a large group of people that want to be responsible, that want to be accountable. They simply don't have the ability to do it with the system that we set up. We've really stacked it against them, and I think in kind of response to what Representative Lesh said, you know, part... When I started prosecuting, I came in very young and naive, and I thought my job was to put everyone in jail. And there certainly is a time and place for that, but as maybe corny as it sounds, I really do think my job is to do justice. And is it really just when I'm talking to someone and they're saying, you know, I'm basically making, whatever, 12 bucks an hour at my job, I have two kids, and my license is suspended, and I owe, and I have seen people in the diversion program owe thousands of dollars. The biggest number I saw was over $10,000 in tickets. And yes, did they accrue that? Absolutely. But they're like, I don't have a choice. Like Mr. Ward said, I still need to drive to pick up groceries, try to get groceries for a family and walk. I mean, I can't imagine. And so in my mind, it's like, yes, there should be a consequence. And I don't have a problem with the prosecutor doing that. But it needs to be appropriate for what the conduct is. Is this someone who's trying? They're not, they're criminal in the sense that we've criminalized the behavior, but they're not like other people that we see come through that are truly just doing bad things to do bad things. And at some point, we have to recognize no matter what their intentions are and how well they want to, they are never going to get over that hump because of this financial burden. And at some point, we have to recognize this and say, is it really fair and just for us to punish this person with incarceration when this is really what's going on? We can do other options, we can do community service, but we've really changed how we approach these cases. And it, as Commissioner Green said, we've even changed our approach as far as even getting convictions, because convictions just compound the problem. You get additional suspensions, collateral consequences, and at some point we have to be responsible for thinking the bigger picture. And I'm absolutely 100% for accountability. Maybe 4 hours of community for service for someone who doesn't have a license, who has two kids and is a single parent, that might be a huge consequence for them, because then how are they going to find the time to do that? Versus we see people every day that come in with means and they do something, you know, you're speeding and it's 90 and a 55. I can write you a $300 check right here. Did that even impact them? Probably not, because they have that kind of means. They can kind of get out of their ticket. We have this such an unfair system when it comes to people with means, and I just think That would be my answer to people that question, why are we doing this? Because it's the right thing to do.
Mr. Chair, if I might also add, under current Minnesota law, that underlying fine, which is supposed to be the penalty, that's your punishment, judges do have discretion over that fine, that they can right-size that based on someone's ability to pay. Minnesota statute specifically prohibits that state surcharge from having that same judicial discretion attached to it. So that's why you end up with the situation so frequently where the pound of flesh that the state is going to take is significantly larger than the actual punishment, which really just seems inappropriate. So what we're suggesting is not, that surcharge, completely go away, but that the bench has the same discretion over the surcharge that it currently has over that underlying fine. And the other component I would add, that might be all that we have, is that if those tickets aren't paid, and I think Ms. Jackson experienced some of this, the late fees and the collections are astronomical.
The reinstatement
fees and all of this. So, $130 ticket, if it's not paid with late fees and a 20% surcharge for sending that ticket to collections, becomes an almost $200 ticket. So there is tremendous incentive to get that paid on time, and none of that would be changed in what we are suggesting that you consider.
So as I look at Ms. Jackson, that I'm hard-pressed to think of legislators on either side of the aisle or either body ever intending the kind of outcome that's been produced here. And I think part of lawmaking is to do that kind of reflection and then make the adjustment. I know that the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker have both spoken publicly about the need to legislate in a transformative way so that government could do things differently, do it smarter, do it more efficiently, and do it in a way, frankly, that saves us important resources. And I think this conversation has unearthed the rationale for doing that relative to the number of issues that are before us in these bills. I want to thank you all for your testimony here today. Members, the House is going to be back on the floor at 5:30. I want to make sure, but we'll probably recess, but I do want to make sure that we have two other groups we want to hear from, and then we also have the commissioners here to speak on your budget. I would like to at least get through that in the next hour or so. And so with that, I'm going to move on to, and I apologize to the Senate. I know that we kind of monopolized the questions on that particular piece, but I'll be sure to call on senators first and the next and the next topic area, which is probation policy and its public safety impacts. And with that, we have from the Rubina Institute, Ms. Kelly Mitchell. Welcome again to the conference committee, Ms. Mitchell. And you have a visual, a
yes, I do.
PowerPoint of some type, right?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm
Kelly
Mitchell.
You want to pull that mic, I think, a little bit closer.
Is that better? I'm Kelly Mitchell, Executive Director of the Rubina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota Law School. I'm a visual person, so that's why there's a PowerPoint up on the screen. And if you don't already have it in printed form, I'm sure that that can be arranged after the hearing. I'm here to talk today about where we are with probation. I have a few new ways to think about probation and why it's important this session to do some form of take some form of action with regard to sentencing for felony probation. This slide I did show you the last time I was here in front of your committee. What this shows is that the Minnesota's felony population, which is the yellow line on this graph, has been growing over time. And just as the volume of prisons is dictated by sentence length and the number of people that we send, the number of people that we convict, The volume and sentence length for probation also dictates the size of our probation population. So here's the picture of the volume. This is going back all the way to 1981 when the sentencing guidelines were put in place originally. And these are the individuals who were convicted of felony offenses each year from 1981 to 2016. The blue part of this bar are the individuals that are sentenced to probation. And consistently, that's about three-quarters of the total number of individuals who are convicted of felony offenses. So we have the number of people being convicted for those offenses increasing. At the same time, 75% of those individuals are going on to the probation population. So volume-wise, we just have more people on probation today than we have in the past. Length is really up to you. For probation, the length of time that an individual will serve on a felony is really determined by statute. It's not determined by the sentencing guidelines. For misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, the terms are very well defined. They range from 1 to 6 years, depending on the severity of the misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor. But for felonies, the terms are open-ended. And range as high, they can go up to as high as the statutory maximum sentence. And here, the statutory maximums for felonies range from about 5 years to 40 years. So we do see probation terms anywhere within that range. This has resulted in variation in probation lengths around the state. Here we see average probation terms ranging from just over 3 years. Here I put it in years instead of in months. Ranging from over 3 years in the 4th District, which is Hennepin, in the 6th District, which is Duluth, the Duluth area. But we see probation terms of over 7 years in the 3rd District, that's the Rochester area, and the 7th District, which runs along I-94 from St. Cloud to Fargo. So we're seeing a lot of variation in different parts of our state. This is the average probation terms by judicial district from 1981 to 2016. It's a chaotic picture, and I hope that it comes across that way. I mean, the only pattern that you can discern from this particular slide is that the 4th District and the 6th District, so that's Minneapolis and Duluth, have consistently imposed shorter probation terms than anywhere else in the state. So I don't know why they do what they do. I've even asked, and they don't know why they do what they do. But they are just consistently different. They have a different philosophy in how they sentence. And everywhere else in the state, the variation is crazy. It's all over the board. It's definitely a local phenomenon. Sentencing is a local phenomenon. And each judicial district is charting its own course. So if we look at probation length by offense type, we see further variation. Probation terms for criminal sexual conduct are probably where you might expect to see them, averaging at about 13 years. But you might be surprised to see that probation terms for person offenses, crimes against persons, are average shorter than property crimes. So it's not much of a difference, but it is a difference that property crimes tend to be a little bit longer than person crimes. If we look at those three types of crimes, person, property, and drug, that's where most people are sentenced in the felony area. If we look at those by judicial district, the 1st District, 4th, and 6th, they tend to impose relatively similar probation lengths no matter which type of crime it is. But when you look at some of the other districts, we see more variation, and the variation is even more pronounced when you look at drug crimes. So here again, in the 4th and 6th, we're looking at a three-year average. In the 7th, we're looking at almost 10 years, a 10-year average probation term. In the 3rd and 10th, we're looking at 8 years. So I think we have to ask ourselves, what justifies those different probation terms around the state. But that's really what this slide makes me think about, what justifies those different terms around the state. This is average probation terms by offense types, person, property, and drug, over time, starting at the beginning of the sentencing guidelines in 1981. And we see that if, in the very beginning, all of the probation terms were low. They rose quickly. Initially, person crimes had longer probation terms, but they've been falling, and the probation terms for drug crimes kept rising and overtook the lengths for person crimes and have stayed above them consistently for the past decade at least. The last time I was here, Senator Limmer asked me the question about which crimes carry 40-year probation terms. And this slide is totally unreadable, but it does answer that question. It does answer which crimes carry long probation terms, period. What this table is, which was put together very hastily, which is why it's hard to read, these are all of the offenses from 2011 to 2016 that received a probation term that was longer than 10 years. And there's a couple of trends that we see on this grid. So within that five-year period, almost 3,000 people received a probation term that was longer than 10 years. 31 cases were sentenced to probation for 40 years. All 31 cases were for drug crimes. They were for first and second degree drug crimes. I have to point out that these 40-year terms for drug crimes were longer than the most serious probation terms for the most serious criminal sexual conduct cases. First degree criminal sexual conduct, the longest probation term ordered for that was 30 years. Somebody with a drug crime got 40 years. 283 cases were sentenced to 30 years or more. They were all drug and criminal sexual conduct cases. After that, the most common probation term within this group would be 20 years. The majority of those were for third-degree drug offenses, and the rest, and the next most common offense was burglary. So those are the types of crimes that are getting those very long probation terms.
And Ms. Mitchell, what's the numerical count in the 20 years?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The numerical count on the 20 years?
Oh, that is 909.
Thank you.
Received 20 years. This slide I hope will shock you a little bit. Going back to the beginning of the sentencing guidelines, in every year since 1981, the average probation term within this state has been longer than the average prison term. We sentence people to probation on average 2 years longer than we sentence people to a prison sentence. So when I think about that, I think, well, wait a minute. The individuals that we sentence to probation, we typically think are less of a public safety risk. We usually use prison for people with a greater public safety risk. But in this instance, we do have a preference for probation, but when we sentence people to probation, we're sentencing them to a longer sentence. And I find that a little hard to reconcile. I find that a little puzzling. But that is indeed what we've done for the last almost 40 years. I'm pulling up right now what this legislature in 1978 said the purpose of the sentencing guidelines is. And there it says the purpose is to maintain uniformity, proportionality, rationality, and predictability in sentencing. Next year, in 2020, we will hit 40 years with our sentencing guidelines. And if we think about what the way that the sentencing guidelines work, for a prison sentence, which again I showed you at the beginning, that's about 30% of the individuals who are sentenced each year. If you look at each cell on the grid where somebody is sentenced to prison, we have a range of time that the court has to sentence individuals within, and they can't go outside of that range without articulating substantial and compelling reasons for imposing a sentence that's either longer than that or shorter than that. But for probation, all that we tell the court is that this should be a probation sentence. And then we have the statute that just opens the door wide. We don't have the same kind of guidance for courts as to what an appropriate probation sentence is. There's no need to articulate reasons when the courts impose 40-year sentences. They can impose a 5-year sentence or a 40-year sentence on the same offense, and they don't have to say anything. Nobody has to say anything about why that's an appropriate sentence. It doesn't comport with the reason, the rationale for enacting the sentencing guidelines in the first place. It doesn't, in my opinion, put us out there as the exemplar of sentencing guidelines that most in other states and in other countries believe Minnesota to be. I don't think it sets a good example. And yet that's what we've done consistently. So I think it's time to take a step back and do something about this. There are several options in the House side of the omnibus bill for things that we could do to bring probation sentencing into a guided system the same way that we've done with prison, to use our resources in a smarter way, the same way that we've done with prison, to, you know, come up with proportional and rational sentencing the same way that we've done with prison. We have an opportunity to do that. There are a lot of options on the table for how we could do that. I think this year should be the year that we do that, so that when we go into 2020 and celebrate 40 years of the sentencing guidelines, we can be really proud that we were the first in the nation to enact the guidelines and that we have kept them going for as long as we have. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Questions? Bless you. Ms. Mitchell, I know that African-American in the state of Minnesota are less than 7% of the total population, but I'm told that they represent 18% of those that are on probation. Is that your thoughts on whether that's not only whether that's disturbing, but whether or not that's something that our sentencing guidelines commission with its mandate on proportionality should find ways to address?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do find the disparities disturbing, and I do think that that is something that the guidelines should address and that actually this legislature should address. In addition to disparities with individuals who are African American, we have huge disparities with individuals who are Native American and higher revocation rates for people who are non-white than people who are white. So definitely there is more work to be done in that area as well.
Okay. Questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wonder, Ms. Mitchell, if you can just, this is following up on the question I had for Ms. Lesh earlier about the fiscally responsible case for this. You've talked about that a little bit, but I feel like if you could just expand on it a bit. Because if we're, you know, it's a pretty costly infrastructure to have, and when I look at having people be out in the community rather than be in prison, that's cheaper than having them be in prison, but it's still pretty expensive, and it's a pretty long period of time. Could you just talk about the kind of the fiscal responsibility angle on this a bit more?
Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. So with the growing population that we have, what that means is that our probation officers are having to supervise more individuals at a time. And when we have really long probation sentences, they also can't cycle those individuals off their caseloads in a fast enough manner so that they can spend the appropriate amount of time that each individual needs. Even if they're able to step people down to lower levels of custody or lower levels of supervision, oftentimes they're still on their caseloads. There's still something that they have to do with those individuals. They don't go away completely, even if they're on an administrative or a banked caseload. The other thing that we need to think about is that just as we have just the same problem that we have in with a very long prison sentence occurs with a long probation sentence, in that there's not necessarily an incentive to make sure that you get the services to the person up front when you know you have a long time to work with them. So you're going to prioritize your services for individuals who you only have you have on your caseload for a short period of time. So in the meantime, the folks who have longer probation terms are languishing and waiting in line behind the people who are being prioritized ahead of them. So there's, you know, it's a cascading effect, just as we've seen with the prison population, that happens in the probation population. It's not efficient, and it's not the best way to use our resources over time.
Thank you. Ms. Mitchell, so the population on probation has grown what over time? What is that number right now?
Mr. Chair, I think it's on the very first slide. Well, I only have the last number for 2017, okay. So it's in the 100,000 range for all misdemeanor through felonies, and then felonies are about half of that.
So 100,000 Minnesotans. There's a provision in the bill related to data that the Guidelines Commission collects. It sounds like pretty rich information. Can you speak just quickly about that provision?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I can. But, you know, currently, right now, we have a lot of information about what individuals are sentenced to. Anecdotally, we know that in some places in the state, some individuals are discharged early. We don't have consistent data that tells us who's getting early discharge and where, and whether that's being done fairly or whether there are also disparities in those practices. We've collected discharge policies in the past, so we know that those vary considerably, and the policies and practices around that vary from county to county. So it'd be nice to know that. How long are people actually serving on probation, so that we could hone in and have a better sense of what the resources are that are needed for that. It'd be also nice to know how many people are being revoked and how many people are committing new crimes. Those are things that we have to pull together on an ad hoc basis today. We don't have that information consistently. So what we're asking for is for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to get a little funding and to have the ability to connect in with the other agencies that have those pieces of data so that we can pull it together and match it with the sentencing data and get that full picture of what's going on in probation.
Seems like the least that we can do so that our decisions can be powerfully data-driven. Thank you. Are there any further questions? Questions from our Senate counterparts? Very well. Thank you, Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you.
And so then our last, our last theme area that is sexual assault, domestic violence, and Representative Bowler, you're going to lead us on that, the sharing on that in that theme area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So we've talked a little bit about some of the bills that are in our omnibus bill, and I know you have some related to criminal sexual conduct in yours as well. But I just wanted to step back and take a little bit of a bigger picture at domestic violence and sexual assault cases. The reality is that we all know someone. Every 92 seconds, an American is sexually assaulted. So by the time I'm done talking today, that will be another sexual assault. We know that every 9 minutes, that victim is a child, and out of 1,000 rapes, only 5 result in incarceration. Now, those are just, you know, statistics, just numbers, and they're important numbers, but we're really at a time right now where the Me Too movement has highlighted the scope of this problem. We had the Denied Justice series
from the Star Tribune. And I think most importantly, we've had a number of brave victim survivors who have come forward, not only in those to the Denied Justice series or as part of the Me Too movement, but here in our committee, we've heard from testimony from a number of survivors who've come forward. And I want to thank you, Senator Latz, for your comments at the beginning of the hearing and your thoughts about the statute of limitations. And I think in light of what victim survivors are telling us right now, it's important for all of us to look at these crimes in a different light. And we have to do more than just tweak the law like we've been doing over a number of years. And it's time for us to enact real justice for victims and survivors. And also to recognize that there's an economic cost to sexual assault, domestic violence, and sexual harassment. If you think about sexual harassment in the workplace, we heard from a victim of sexual harassment, and I believe you heard from the same victim when you talked about your sexual harassment bill, who worked in the restaurant industry, and the way her job was impacted for a year by the quote-unquote stalkers, as her staff called them, that came into that restaurant, and how her behavior shifted, her ability to serve her customers shifted, how it affected all of her coworkers too in her workplace. That was just one example of the cost of sexual harassment in her job. And we also know that intimate partner violence costs hundreds of millions of dollars in lost productivity of employees. I was just looking for some numbers, and this is probably an outdated number by now, but it was from 2003, I believe. It was $700 million for the cost of intimate partner violence to workplaces. So with that, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, Lindsay Bryce is here from INCASA, and I just had a couple of questions to ask her. I'm sure others might have questions for her. Please. As well. So do you want to just first go ahead and introduce yourself? I know you've been here before. And
sure, I can do that. Thank you. I'm Lindsay Bryce. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I'm the Law and Policy Director there. And I guess before you ask me a few questions, I just want to thank everyone here for the amount of time that you've spent hearing from people like me. I've been in front of you a number of times. I've been in front of both chairs. Committees a number of times, and for all of the time that you've spent speaking to and listening to victims and survivors. That's impactful. And then just to echo the thank you, I really appreciate your words today. I was here last week as well, and you know, I've reached out, and I really appreciate your words, and I appreciate your ability to take in additional information and grow from that, because even you're absolutely right, Representative Mueller. We all know a survivor. We all know victims and survivors, even though we don't know necessarily we know them. But we don't all have all of the other information. And I think that's one thing you spoke to today, and really appreciate that.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Bryce, if you can just tell us, why do you think it's important for us to act now, to act this year?
Ms. Bryce.
Thank you. I've been doing just a little bit about me, not because I need to tell you about myself, but because I think it's important context. I have been working in this area since the 90s. I was first trained as an advocate at what was the Program Against Sexual Violence. It's now the Aurora Center at the University of Minnesota. I've worked in both standalone sexual assault programs, dual sexual assault, domestic violence programs. I spent almost 10 years as a prosecutor. So I've really touched a number of different areas of this issue in a variety of different ways. And one of the things that I see that's really different today than it was in the 90s or even 10 years ago is that today we are hearing on a daily basis, we are hearing from victims and survivors who are able to, for a whole variety of different reasons, able to tell their story and share their experiences, and they are absolutely telling us what they need, and they're telling their legislators what they need, and I'm confident that most of the people here have heard from at least one victim or survivor throughout your tenancy in the legislature. And And I just think that's a big change. When I started in this, the sexual assault movement was really, it's really a grassroots movement, and it really started, I'm not going to get into a whole bunch of history, but it's historically been advocacy, organizing in a really grassroots way, and we've gotten much more organized in different ways since the beginning, but this very grassroots movement around supporting victims and survivors and then really uplifting those stories. And I think that what I've seen change is we still have that, absolutely have that going on, but we have a system of programs that are filled with both people who are really invested in this issue for any number of reasons, and with survivors who are doing this work. And then, I don't want to say separately, but overlapping with that, we also have these much more organized groups of victims and survivors that are speaking out and talking to us speaking up publicly and telling their truths and talking about what damage our systems are doing.
Representative Mueller.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And if you could just walk us through, I don't know if you have a list there of some of your priorities this year.
Yeah, I can do that. Chair, thank you. We have four priorities that are items that were really dealt with last year, but were part of the larger omnibus bill. And so obviously didn't get dealt with. One of them has already been passed unanimously by the House and Senate and signed by the governor, and that is the voluntary relationships repeal. And we are very appreciative that has already happened. The three other items, two of them are in both the House and Senate omnibus bills. One is the bill that would, or the language that would add peace officers to the list of individuals who cannot have consensual sexual contact with, in this case, folks in custody. That is in both omnibus bills. A position of authority. I should have written all these down. Position of authority is an issue that we have been working on. And I'm using the global we, but I've been part of MnCASA in peripheral ways for a number of years. But my predecessor has been working on this, and dozens of community members and attorneys have been working on position of authority for close to 10 years. And that is really the sort of quintessential example of that is the student who is groomed during the school year. But no sexual contact happens until, say, the summertime, when they're then they're considered no longer a student. And our position of authority language doesn't cover those acts that happen in the summer, because they wouldn't be considered a position of authority because they were your seventh grade teacher last year, for example. So that language is in both omnibus bills. We have a little bit of a goofy situation in Minnesota statute where we protect a body part as a private body part only when unclothed. So we've been calling it the buttocks bill, and it's the bill that would add buttocks to the clothed buttocks to the list of protected body parts under our statute. That's that was heard in both bodies. But I believe, if my memory is correct, I believe it's only currently in the House omnibus bill. Am I incorrect? Chair Limmer's shaking his head. My memory may be wrong on that. I don't have it in front of me.
Mr. Chair and others, we passed the bill, a standalone bill, Senate File 111, and that it was included in that bill, as was the voluntary relationship repeal funding. Is in our omnibus bill. The peace officer consensual contact is in that bill. The position of authority is in that bill. And of course, the buttocks bill is in that bill.
Thank you. The buttocks bill was the one I couldn't remember sitting here in front of you today, so I appreciate that. So those are our priorities that we've been working on for some time. The additional priority is is really taking all of those items and asking, we're asking you to create a working group or some sort of organized group to really do this work more holistically and more expansively, so we don't come to you every year with, here's another small thing that needs to, and not small thing, here's another concise thing that needs to get fixed, here's an additional fix that needs to be made. We're asking to try to provide those recommendations all at once using a multidisciplinary group.
Mr. Chair, and I know that you and I,
I'm sorry, if I may quickly interrupt. My timing's a bit awkward here, but my daughter's senior prom photos are starting in 25 minutes, and I'm going to excuse myself. But I support the proposals that are before us on this topic.
Many blessings to your daughter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My son and his friends will be here in about 20 minutes also, so you can do a joint photograph.
Another prom parent. I miss those years.
That's right. I just wanted to ask you some of the things that you and I have discussed, kind of trying to figure out what legislation might look like this year, and especially with the working group, is the voluntary intoxication piece. And I know there was a House bill that looked different from the Senate bill, and that was an example of one of those topics that we really needed to dive in, and we thought the working group would be best to address that issue, if you wanted to speak a little bit more to that.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Absolutely. I'm going to assume that everybody in the room has read the Star Tribune's Denied Justice series, and if you haven't, I would really encourage you to do so. There's just a deep dive into both stories and experiences of Minnesota victims and survivors, as well as some pretty amazing statistics and analysis. But one of the themes of that, and one of the themes that we have heard consistently from our both victims and survivors and from advocacy programs, is that the cases involving alcohol or other substances are difficult at best to prosecute, and one of the reasons that they're difficult is the way our statutes are written. Our statutes are written in a way that we talk about mental incapacitation and physically helpless. We did a little bit of work prior to session to see if we could figure out a fairly quick fix to that. And to be perfectly frank, we had about a dozen lawyers in the room and a handful of advocates and survivors. And we spent about 4 hours one day kind of going over and over and over, and we all walked out and said, I think this might work, and showed it to some other folks, including Representative Mueller, who pointed out something that we hadn't even thought of that was a problem. So it's just an example of how these are complicated statutes, and we need to fix them properly. And in order to do that, we really do need to have as many voices as possible involved in that process, because otherwise we don't know what we don't know. And we don't want to accidentally miss something and create an unintended consequence.
Representative Mueller.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this is just probably my last comment, but I just wanted to say, too, there are a number of bills that, even though they're not on your priority list, there are things that you are supportive of in general. And I just wanted to kind of tick some of these are related to domestic violence, so they're not necessarily MnCASA's priority, but I just wanted to mention just a few of those with your permission, Mr. Chair. And these, I think all of these bills had broad bipartisan support. So we had the establishing the Domestic Abuse Transformation Program Fund, adding domestic abuse no contact orders to the list of evidence, clarifying crimes of harassment and stalking, the sexual harassment bill removing severe or pervasive from that, marriages by minors. We've got eliminating the criminal statute, the statute of limitations in criminal sexual contact cases, broadening the definition of position of authority, which is a little bit different from the position of authority bill that that Ms. Rice spoke about already. We've got establishing sex trafficking investigations coordinator, clarifying first-degree criminal sexual conduct, and that was the bill that I talked about in relation to a Supreme Court case that came out in December of 2018. And then post-board standards,
making sure that law enforcement agencies have good standards to go by for investigating these cases, and then the task force for missing and murdered Indigenous women are some of the bills that we've talked about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mulder. Thank you, Ms. Price. You know, members, I'm going to push on because the floor is back in session at 5:30, and we can kind of fudge that a bit, but I think one of our members actually has a bill up on the floor. I do want to move over to our commissioners then, so that part of the conversation.
Chair Mariani, can I just make one really quick?
Ms. Price, please.
Thank you so much. Two things. Number one, I just really want to thank everybody here in this room for the bipartisan support we've seen for many, many, many sexual assault-related bills and issues this year, and that's very much appreciated. And then two, my comments to Senator Latz earlier, it's in that same vein of we don't know what we don't know, and if any of you are looking at these kinds of issues and are looking for resources or, you know, wanting to have conversations about it, please don't hesitate to reach out to us because we are a resource for you as well. And thank you so much for having me here today.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to state I misspoke when I answered your question. I said that Senate File 111 was passed. We're awaiting Senate action.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you, Chairman Limmer. Thank you, Ms. Price. Commissioner Schnell, Department of Corrections. And again, members, what we're doing is focusing on the big purpose question, the why. And so generally what we're looking for is an explanation of what you put. Oh, that's great. We'll have all the commissioners up here. That's good. Be very efficient. We understand the why part of the budget in terms of keeping Minnesota safe and what would happen if those are not funded or not well funded. Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to come in and talk tonight. I'm going to really keep this very short, as was the interest. And I think not get into so deep into the weeds that we've really covered, I think, in many respects here. And talk a little bit just about the importance of the Department of Corrections as it relates and all of the work that gets done there as it relates to the safety and security of Minnesota. Having spent the last over 30 years really focused more heavily on catching people ultimately bringing them to the criminal justice system in my previous life in law enforcement, something I'm still very proud of and recognize that role is critical for the safety of our state. I now find myself in a position where I and the department that I represent is focused really on trying to help those who've done wrong, do the right thing going forward. And that becomes really critical for us as we think about the provisions that are before you, the decisions that this body is being asked to make. Not long ago, I visited Oak Park Heights, and during the course of that visit, I had the opportunity to speak with both inmates as well as staff. And I was, as I was walking through, we were in one of the units with long-term offenders, and a man who had been in prison for more than 20 years was talking to me about the experience of being in prison that long, what it meant, and what the possibility of being released meant to him. The fact that he had was an entirely different person some 20 years after he had committed a very serious offense. He also talked about the experience of being there and what the people that do the work of corrections mean ultimately to the people who are incarcerated. And he made mention of the sergeant that I happened to be walking through the facility with, who had been there himself 19 years. And this inmate pointed to that officer and made the observation that the two of them grew up together, that this person, this man who had been incarcerated, was sent to prison, rightly for a serious crime at age 19, now just more than 40 years old. The man who I was walking with, the sergeant, came into that facility at around the age of 20 and now was in his early 40s. Truly, the two of them did grow up together. And I think as we talk about all the things around criminal justice, as we talk about all the things that we've talked about the course of this session, about safety and security, about the need for additional resources to provide for our officers and to have technology, to have an ombudsperson, to provide a third party for people who are incarcerated, to have another vehicle, a mechanism to have their grievances addressed, to have resources both by policy as well as by practice to address the needs of those who are sanctioned within the prison system and through restrictive housing, to make sure that that's done appropriately and respectfully, to invest a little bit more upstream in terms of having some resources to provide for the ongoing provision of the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. And I think also to look at policy provisions around smart use of probation, expanding the role of decision-making around life sentence parole decisions. These are all, I think, important features, and I am so grateful to all of you and the committees who've given attention to these issues over the course of this session. And I implore you and ask that you give really thoughtful and consideration to the needs of our department that ultimately will improve the outcomes of people who are incarcerated in our facilities, under supervision across our state, on probation or supervised release, that ultimately is about creating stronger communities, and it is only through stronger communities that we have increased safety. Having people separated, having people feel disengaged for the long haul, as has been much of the theme throughout many of the topics that you've talked about even tonight. The importance of engagement around these really difficult issues, I think, is essential to the safety of Minnesota, both today and going forward. And I appreciate all the work that this committee has done, and I would stand for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know, of course, that the corrections component of our bill here involves very sizable appropriations, mostly targeted at base operations. But I'm struck by your testimony that that the impression I get is that as important and critical as those are best safeguarded and best accentuated by the policy provisions that you've also brought forward, that there's a interwoven connection, between space that creates new ways to do things at the same time that we meet our obligation to properly fund our correction system. Commissioner Lucero, I'm going to go to you, or I can wait for you last. I see you're kind of writing, but I thought, are you ready?
Absolutely, yeah.
Very good.
Sure.
Commissioner Lucero.
Great. Well, I really want to thank everyone for welcoming me this evening. So I think you have also heard me speak many times and tell stories about the importance of this work. So I thought after a long few days here, we should maybe try something a little bit differently. So I just want to start by asking how many of you folks have grandparents or have had grandparents? Oh, good. Everyone's raising their hands. Yes, thanks. This is a participatory testimony for the first time ever. Well, I just wanted to start by telling you a little bit about my grandma. That's my grandma Emma. She helped raise me, and she grew up with her large family on the family farm in the cold mountains, high up in the mountains in New Mexico. That's where my family has lived long before it became New Mexico. I don't believe she went to high school, at least not for long. She worked so hard her entire life in ways that I can't even begin to fathom. When I was a kid, she worked as a house servant, caring for other people's kids, cleaning houses. So this isn't a unique story. I'm sure every single one of us in this room have this story. We are only here today because of our ancestors who worked hard to get us to where we are. The privilege to be here with each of you is not lost on me, and it's not lost on you. We are all working to make sure that all who come after us are able to live full lives, full of dignity and opportunity, especially for people like my grandma and your grandmas too. See, my grandma died in horrific pain of cancer when I was in my early 20s. It destroyed me. I know you can understand that feeling. We've all lost people who we continue to carry with us in our hearts long after they're gone. As she passed away, she only spoke in Spanish. That was the only language she spoke when she died. And I couldn't really understand her. While I understand a fair amount of Spanglish, especially if it's spoken slowly, I couldn't understand what my grandma was saying to me, and that's because I don't speak Spanish fluently. Both of my grandparents, on both my mom and dad's side, intentionally did not teach it to us. They didn't teach it to us because they wanted to protect us from the harm that they had gone through with school, in jobs, and in public spaces because of the color of their skin, because they spoke Spanish. For instance, my grandma told me how she was locked in the closet by her teacher at school repeatedly for speaking Spanish. Because she loved me, my grandma tried to shield me from harm. And because she loved me, I couldn't understand what my grandma was saying to me as she died. So my grandma is just one of the many reasons why I want to do this work, why I'm inspired to do this work every day, to make sure that everyone can lead lives full of dignity and joy, free from discrimination. My grandma didn't really get that dignity. That's why the Department of Human Rights is so important. I think it's really important to look at what are human rights, what does that mean? Human rights are standards that allows all people to live with dignity, freedom, equality, justice, and peace. Every person has these rights simply because they are human beings. They are guaranteed to everyone without distinction of any kind, things such as race, color, sex, disability, religion, national origin. Human rights are essential to the full development of individuals and to strong communities. They reflect the minimum standards necessary for people to live lives with dignity. So too many people in our community don't have that, and we can choose differently here. And I just want to stop for a second and acknowledge that the topic of this section is called public safety or corrections and safety. And so I think oftentimes there's this question about why is human rights sitting up there? And I really just want to honor and lift up the statement that Commissioner Schnell just made that safety, only through strong communities do we have safety. And that's fundamentally what the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is talking about. It's talking about building strong communities. So we are part of this trifecta that's up here when it comes to really putting together strong Minnesota. Creating safety for everyone in the state must include a broader conception than just security. That's what Commissioner Schnell talked about. And it has to include a broader conception than just public safety, one that ensures that every Minnesotan is included and welcome in our Minnesota community. So the state's population is increasing rapidly. I am getting older. I could do another interactive piece and ask if anyone else is getting older here, but I'm supposed to just assure all of you that you're looking very young. And this opens us up to growing disabilities. So many of us have disabilities. Many of us will face disabilities or have family members and loved ones that face disabilities and need to navigate work and our needs for accommodations. We're also getting more racially diverse. Minnesota has some of the worst racial disparities across the board in housing, employment, education, and health, and we've talked about that all day today. We know we have to do things differently in Minnesota, or else we're going to face further inequities and further tension. So this is a choice. Discrimination, hate, unconscious bias can be met with silence or half-hearted rebukes, or we can choose differently. Across the world, there's a lot of divisive work going on. It's meant to divide us. It's meant to turn everything into an us versus them narrative. I'm not sure if you folks saw this flyer that was that's been circulating around Princeton in Minnesota here these past few days. This has been all over the town, and it's been talked about all over the news and Facebook page. And what it says on the top is, it says, I'm sorry, there's a picture right here of what's purported to be a couple. The woman is a white woman and the man's a black man here. And it says, race mixing. Is this seriously what we want for our future? This picture captured in your healthy northern town of Princeton is the future that we can look forward to if good men and women do not take a stand against it. A future that is dark and where our descendants no longer look like us. Some of us still care. Love your own people. This is all over the place in that town right there. So when I talked about my grandma, I was worried that it would come across as this is a problem of the past, as that sometimes often said when we're talking about human and civil rights. And I just want to make it really clear that every single day across Minnesota, there is a lot of work that needs to be done. And one of my favorite things about this work is that we get to push back against this kind of divisive neighborhood discussion. We get to say that we belong to each other, that my success is interconnected with your success, that we are all one Minnesota, that when it comes to human rights, we are not divided. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights is full of hardworking and dedicated employees who are working to create a strong Minnesota, to meet discrimination, hate, and unconscious bias head on. We have a lot of work to do, and it will take all of us doing this work in partnership and collaboration with the work of all of the agencies up here. And so I really want to thank you for everything you're doing, especially during these really long days, to push forward on all of this. Please let me know how myself and my staff can work with you as you move forward, and have a great rest of the evening. And, of course, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Lucetto. We do have floor in a few minutes. So I'm going to ask my House colleagues to hang in there. I do know Representative Mueller has to go because of the prom, and that absolutely is a priority, would be for me as well. But we do have, I think we saved the best for last, Director Evans. So welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and that's a lofty goal, Mr. Chair, as following these two and their very articulate rendition of the work that they do is difficult to follow. I'm here on behalf of Commissioner Harrington, who also had a very important prior engagement with a family member that he needed to be at. What I would like to tell all of you, I also have with me is Assistant Commissioner Hodges, who you haven't spent a lot of time with, but you will get to know in the coming times that we spend together. What is interesting from my perspective as we listen is that to the two commissioners discuss is we really all have the same goal. We have the same goal of creating successful, safe communities across Minnesota, because that goal is what we really need to make all of the people in this state successful. And if they don't have that safety and security to begin with, it becomes very challenging for our children and communities to thrive across Minnesota. The Minnesota Department of Public Safety works in collaboration with our partners across the public safety spectrum to provide often specialized services across our communities as our agencies work to promote public safety across the state of Minnesota. I thank all of you, as others have, for the work that you've done in examining the work you have in this committee and the work that you're doing ongoing with the budgets that you're preparing and the difficult choices that you have to make. What I want to let you know is the governor's budget really reflects that, as I just said, working in collaboration with our public safety partners. His support of drug support to the BCA as we work to ensure turnaround times are at acceptable levels, that we're providing assistance to our local law enforcement, ensures that justice is being served in those communities quickly so that we're able to move people either into the system where they need to be or that they get the help that they need. Our APHIS system is designed to provide both ongoing real time as people are being booked into jails, but also importantly, it's the backbone of your background checks that you implement here at the legislature, and that system needs to be operating effectively. Cybersecurity, as you've discussed in this committee and others, is vitally important and continues to be a threat that we all face in government, and to ensure that our data is secure. That's the FBI cybersecurity component of that as well. Pipeline safety and school safety, you've talked about here as well, that we want to make sure that our schools are safe so that our children are able to learn in a safe environment, and the governor has recognized that with additional resources. Vulnerable adult investigation, as was noted, we're all getting older and our population is aging very quickly in the state of Minnesota, and that opens the door for people to take advantage of our aging population, which the governor has recognized with additional resources to fund vulnerable adult investigations. One of the priorities of the governor is the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force. One of the ways that we also provide assistance in the Department of Public Safety is to convene groups in that process to really ask the questions. Why do we have higher rates of missing persons in our indigenous communities? Why are we experiencing greater rates of murdered women in those communities as well? So that we can convene and provide answers to all of you as policymakers to make decisions to help make those communities thrive across Minnesota. Sexual assault training and investigation, you just examined that in an earlier component of this, that there's resources there to provide better training to our Minnesota law enforcement partners to ensure that those cases are being fully investigated, that we're doing the best job we can from an investigative protocol so that prosecutors can make decisions on how to pursue those investigations and cases. And then for the Department of Public Safety, the core technology services that have been funded will allow us to continue moving forward into the 21st century as an agency to make sure that we are being the most efficient and effective we can as an organization. And so I would just close by saying fully funding the governor's budget and request, as others have noted here, is really not an investment in our agencies in particular. It's an investment in communities across Minnesota, as those investments are into our agency to provide assistance to each community across Minnesota, partnering together with both our local, tribal, and federal entities as we work collectively across Minnesota to keep our communities safe. And so with that, right, so you can get where you need to be, I will close if there's any questions for any of us.
I want to thank the three commissioner or two commissioners and director who speak on behalf of DPS, commissioner, for spending your time with us here, sharing what I think is not only appropriate base request for appropriate basic appropriations on the part of legislature so that we meet our responsibility and our constitutional obligations. I know, Senator Limmer, you've often have called on the legislature to set that as the firm foundation of what we do here, but to do so also in a very visionary way, in a looking toward the future and investing in the future way, whether it's investing in our technology enhancement, whether it's investing in making sure our presence is strong across the state, or whether it's investing in those strong policy complements to our corrections work. I think our state is being well served by the vision that comes forward from each of your respective departments and agencies. Members, I am going to finish or recess us at 5:30 in a few minutes. I want to close out. I would have done questions here, but I do want to make sure that we're moving forward here so that we can meet our floor obligation. The question at this point is, how do we proceed then as a conference committee? I could tell you that the House is certainly ready to put proposals on the table. I'm hoping that the Senate is also ready to do that. The clock is obviously ticking. I get the issue of the target, makes it very difficult, but I do know that, bless you, other conference committees have been successful in a bipartisan way to put the basic elements of an omnibus bill together. I don't see any reason why we can't do that as well. This has been an unorthodox way to do this today. I'm Puerto Rican, and so, you know, I'm kind of unorthodox because we tell stories. We talk about the why. We talk about the purpose consistently in my culture, and that serves as a basis for decision-making. I was born and grew up in the States. I'm a proud American, and so that means I've interacted with my fair share of Norwegians and Germans and Irish and Italian. I could tell you that those communities, along with communities of color, are also storytelling communities that dig deep into wisdom. I hope that we're going to be able to dig deep into our collective wisdom as we put together, mechanically put together, the bill that we're required to do so. It's our duty to do so. And so my suggestion is that we take a recess. Senator Limmer, perhaps you and I can find a few minutes during our recess. We could talk about what our next steps are going to be. today and tomorrow, and then we'll come back and report back to our colleagues. So with that, yes, Chairman Lemon, please.
Chairman, let me make a quick comment. As you might remember, when we had our very first day in conference committee, I raised the reality that we did not have a new budget target. As of this hour, we still do not have a budget target. It makes it very difficult to conclude a conference committee without, that is intended to be a budget bill, without a budget target. And we've listened carefully to all of the testimony, and now we're hearing it a second round, and we certainly know the import of the approach that you are all making. But from a practical standpoint, it's going to be very hard to come to a conclusion until I get that. I have not been told any indication of what that budget target may be. Perhaps you have, but I certainly haven't gotten it. I'm as anxious as you are to conclude this conference committee. We've always approached, and I thought I gave clear signal at the very beginning of this year, that this is a budget bill and not a policy bill. But it's quite a bit different between both chambers. And we've tried to take our priorities, many of which have been addressed here by those addressing policy, that we found our priorities, we passed those priorities, and now most of them have been passed off the Senate floor, and many, if not all, are now sitting in your Ways and Means Committee in the House, where they could be passed individually. I'm a little perplexed right now, but I hope we can come to conclusion. I welcome the thought of discussing it with you, Mr. Chairman. But I've got a little bit of my hands tied until I get a budget. And I don't quite know how to go forward. And at that, I'm going to state this, just have to pause. We certainly want this done. There's individuals with maybe a higher pay scale than we have that's trying to come to that point on a big scale. Some of your policies we have not heard at all. Some didn't even have Senate files, and there's the request for us to accept them. I believe in a committee process. I believe in discussing issues. I believe to ferret them out. And there's quite a bit on the table. You have a very energetic group of legislators with a lot of ideas, some very creative. And quite honestly, many of those might just take some type of focus over the interim to really get it polished. But I'm just telling you the difficulty that we have on the Senate side, Mr. Chairman, of how to begin without a budget target.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do sincerely appreciate and understand your perspective and the position that you're in. I'm kind of in the same position. I don't think, though, however, members, that we need to conclude this bill today. I think we can do what a number of other omnibus conference committees have been doing over the course of the last 2 weeks, which is getting to agreement on things that that they agree on, and putting forward sensible, good public policy as the beginning of getting toward a final bill. I don't see any reason why this conference committee, giving the goodwill and the intelligence around the table, can't do that. Members, you all know that what we're asked to do is to get somewhere together. And to get somewhere together means that there's going to be give and take. There's going to be things that both bodies find important. I suspect there are provisions in the Senate bill that do not have a House provision. I know of one that came in pretty late during the Senate process that had a price tag to it. I am open to that conversation because I see our work not as being the House's work only or the Senate works only, but the Minnesota State Legislature's work. And I fully engage in this process knowing that all the things that I want, I'm not going to get, the House isn't going to get, but I fully optimistically believe that we can put together a strong bill that honors the good hard work that both of our bodies have done. And so that's my approach to this. I'm actually optimistic. I know it's going to be tough, but I just know that we have much more in common than we don't. And I am anxious about those target numbers. I wish I knew something. My leadership has not shared anything with me that, quite frankly, I'm probably going to learn about it through Twitter at some point. but until that time, I think there's a lot of good work that we can do together. And quite frankly, that we can do together. That has been the tradition of this conference committee in the past, where there has been a good, strong mixture of finance and policy that both sides can live with and that think it's good public policy. So with that, members, I'm going to call us into recess. Please look for a notice. I'll try to get you as much heads up as possible. Chairman Limmer, perhaps you and I can find some time to do some chatting in that period of time. I really appreciate it. So members, this committee stands in recess.